Today is Tuesday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, an update on reports of gunfire in Sudan's capital. And Iran says it has arrested an undisclosed number of suspects accused of a role in shooting down a Ukrainian airliner.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said it wasn't possible for only one person to be blamed for the incident or to be punished. Others are culpable, he said, and this case should be explained.
Plus, Democrats look to decide today when to send articles of impeachment to the Senate. Those stories and more are all coming up next. In Sudan, heavy gunfire erupted in the capital on Tuesday amid a dispute between agents of the country's long-feared National Intelligence and Security Service and forces loyal to the transitional government. The Minister for Information, Faisal Mohamed Saleh, confirmed the shootings at several facilities in Khartoum. The government says intelligence service troops were responsible. The intelligence service was the powerful security arm of longtime leader Omar al-Bashir. He was ousted last year after months of massive protests in the country. Reporters in the city tell VOA that some streets are deserted and there is a heavy deployment of army and paramilitary troops known as the Rapid Support Forces at key government institutions. Shortly after the gunfire began, the service announced it had fired some employees who were unhappy with the severance package they were offered. Officials say negotiations were taking place to try and resolve the problem. Sudan is undergoing a three-year political transition overseen by civilians and the military following the overthrow of Bashir in April. Stay tuned to VOA for additional updates as details emerge. Iran said on Tuesday it had arrested an undisclosed number of suspects accused of a role in shooting down a Ukrainian airliner as anti-government demonstrations triggered by the disaster entered a fourth day. Iran's president said a special court should be formed to probe the downing of the passenger jet that was mistakenly targeted by Iranian forces just after takeoff from Tehran, killing all 176 people aboard. VOA's Jeff Custer has the details.
Initially, senior officials in Iran dismissed allegations that a missile had brought down the jetliner. In the face of mounting evidence, however, Iran acknowledged on January 11th, 3 days after the crash, that its Revolutionary Guard had shot down the Ukrainian plane by accident. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said it wasn't possible for only one person to be blamed for the incident or to be punished. Others are culpable, he said, and this case should be explained. Iran shot down the plane when it was bracing for a possible U.S. retaliation for a ballistic missile attack on two military bases housing U.S. troops in Iraq. The shooting down of the plane and the lack of transparency around the incident has reignited anger at the country's leadership, with protesters taking to the streets in past days. Online videos appeared to show security forces firing live ammunition and tear gas to disperse protests in the street. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
The Trump administration has insisted last week's strike on Iran's top general was because of a threat of an imminent attack. But officials say it was motivated by a broader effort. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that part of the story.
They said the threat was imminent, but top Trump officials struggled to describe the targets or timing. They're now acknowledging the strike on Qasem Soleimani had a more fundamental purpose, reining in Iran.
Our ability to deter attacks had obviously broken down.
President Trump and those of us in his national security team are reestablishing deterrence.
Attorney General William Barr and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday, hours before the president himself implicitly acknowledged deterrence was the goal in killing Soleimani.
And it should have been done 20 years ago.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Washington has also rejected a request by the Iraqi government to pull out its troops and has threatened possible sanctions in response. Now, joining us now to further discuss the tensions in the region is Craig Albert. He is the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
So we heard that a possible motive of taking out General Soleimani was deterrence. Looking at the region, will that have its desired effect?
I'm not sure if it'll have a desired effect in the region. I think more broadly, we can think of it as a deterrent for the entire international community. So President Trump could have been doing this not just to target Iran or strategic adversaries in the Middle East, but also think about North Korea and Russia. So President Trump is saying, look, the United States will strike. We will strike boldly, and we will target regime officials. And I think that that could be a deterrent to North Korea more than it was meant for any actor in the Middle East.
If we continue our discussions with Iraq, they have requested that the United States pull out. The United States is rejecting that request and has also asked NATO to play a larger role in the region. What impact do those kinds of discussions have on the overall security in the region?
Every impact. We know when the United States departed in 2010, 2011, the rise of ISIS, took the place and filled that power vacuum. If the United States leaves without some type of military strategic security force in the area, you're likely to see more of that. The resurgence of ISIS or other groups that are yet unknown or unnamed or unformed are likely to take the place. The Iraqi military and police structure is still in its infancy and not quite capable yet of handling its own security. So it needs some type of external defense to help it. So I think having the United States play some role, at least with special forces operations or drone operations, while cooperating with the Iraqi intelligence apparatus is necessary. If not the U.S., then some strategic alliance needs to be formed to help internal security.
You also brought up the topic that many others have as well, as a possible resurgence of the Islamic State militant group. Given the aftermath of the strike and the response by Iran, what do you see as that being a possibility?
Well, I absolutely think that ISIS is waiting to make a move and to cause even more tension. You can probably expect some type of attacks in Baghdad itself to try to spur on the United States to retaliate without telling the Iraqi officials that that's what we're doing. So to try to sever the relationship even more between the government of Iraq and the United States. So ISIS is going to try to play a bystander of this and make the two forces go against each other or separate from one another even more. So that's bound to happen fairly quickly.
Focusing more squarely on Iran, we have had several days of protests after the government came out and acknowledged that it had shot down the Ukrainian passenger jet. But in 2019, we also had a long series of protests where people were upset with the government, asking clerics and government officials to resign. Do you see these recent protests as having any kind of impact on how the government is going to approach the situation with its own constituency?
Too early to tell. The government of Iran has been remarkably capable at putting down protests after only a few weeks or months. So its regime is very strong in being able to handle this type of protest and making sure that they don't elevate to anything much more serious. So right now, I would say that these will die down in a few days. But with the likelihood that protests could continue, if the regime doesn't strike down, it could mark more of a democratic movement in Iran. We know that about 35% to 40% of people under the age of 35 are pro-democratic in Iran. So that group could cause something more severe or catastrophic that the Iranian regime is not used to when it comes to, you know, democratic protests or protests in general. So it'll be interesting to see what way the regime handles this.
Craig Albert is the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Republican senators have rejected plans to dismiss the articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has those details.
With Senate Republicans still debating the rules of the proceedings for the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, there are indications there won't be a simple vote to dismiss the articles of impeachment. Over the weekend, Trump suggested he might prefer simply dismissing the charges. But Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said Monday, "I think our members generally are not interested in the motion to dismiss." Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine has also said she would oppose a motion to dismiss. The House must still appoint the managers who will act as prosecutors in the Senate trial. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Joining us now to discuss the topic further is David Barrett, a professor of political science at Villanova University. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. Thank you.
So I wanted to get your take on what you think, based on what we've heard, not only with the recent report and several senators from the Republican side of the aisle saying that they want to hear some more evidence. What do you think a trial in the Senate may look like, given that the articles of impeachment look to be heading over sometime soon?
Well, I don't think they're going to simply dismiss the charges right away. There will be a consideration of evidence. The bigger, more interesting question is, might witnesses be called? And I think most, I'm sure most Republicans don't want that to happen. It's not likely, but, you know, it takes a handful of Republicans to change the game. Senators from states like Maine and Utah and a few other places. But I don't see enough, I don't see a big hints coming from them that they're going to force Mitch McConnell to make that happen. So I'm just going to guess a trial of, I don't know, a couple of weeks, nothing too terribly long, consideration of evidence. It would be fascinating if witnesses were called before the Senate who were not called before the House Intelligence Committee, which now seems a very long time ago. But
right, because it's been a month since the articles of impeachment were passed.
Yes. So Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, absolutely has his eye on keeping a Republican majority in the Senate. I think this matters. This is probably the top priority. So he has to sort of navigate, and he's very good at this, navigate between sort of pro-Trump hardliners, of whom there are many, at least in terms of what they say publicly, and a few who are not pro-Trump hardliners, who want there to be some serious consideration of evidence, at least, if not new witnesses.
We have about 40 seconds left. Mitch McConnell, the speaker in the Senate Majority Leader, Speaker Pelosi over in the House is his counterpart. Has delaying sending over the articles hurt the Democrats in their bid to keep control of the House in the 2020 election and gain a majority in the 2018 with those Senate seats that are up for election?
I doubt it. This is not the sort of thing that voters, especially with the passage of many months that are to come before the election, I cannot imagine that this is going to have any serious impact on House races in November.
David Barrett is a professor of political science at Villanova University. Thank you again for your insight today.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve.
The Democrats running for president hold their seventh debate this evening, less than 3 weeks before the Iowa caucuses. The AP's Tim McGuire has more.
Tension in the Democrats' debate Tuesday night in Des Moines should be higher than previously. For one thing, it will be an all-white lineup. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is out. Andrew Yang and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick didn't make the cut. There might be a growing rift between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren amid a report that Sanders' campaign told followers to speak poorly of Warren's chances with undecided voters. Then there's a CNN report confirmed by Warren that Sanders told her in 2018 he didn't think a woman could win the election. Former Vice President Joe Biden is likely to take shots from those two as well as the others on the stage. Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and billionaire Tom Steyer. I'm Tim McGuire.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1929, Edwin Hubble, astronomer and namesake of the famous space telescope, provided evidence that the universe was expanding. To determine the rate of expansion, Hubble came up with a unit of measurement called the Hubble constant. Initially, Hubble estimated the universe was expanding at a rate of 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec is equal to about 3.26 million light years. Over the years, astronomers have lowered estimates of the Hubble constant down to between 50 and 100 kilometers per megaparsec. Astrophysicists from Clemson University recently used new techniques and data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope and the Imaging Atmospheric Cherenkov Telescopes to determine the Hubble constant. They estimate the universe is expanding at a rate of nearly 67.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. Treasury Department has dropped its designation of China as a currency manipulator days before top officials, the world's two largest economies, are due to sign a new trade agreement. Reuters' Eve Johnson has that story.
The U.S. Treasury Department says China will no longer be branded a currency manipulator. The move on Monday is seen as a symbol of goodwill as the two countries get ready to sign a trade deal. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin first slapped Beijing with the label back in August when trade tensions were soaring. It was the first time the Treasury had done so in 25 years. Mnuchin accused China of deliberately holding down the value of its currency to make its goods cheaper to sell overseas. But according to the Treasury's latest report, China has made, quote, enforceable commitments to refrain from competitive devaluation. It also noted that China's yuan currency has bounced back after hitting a low against the dollar in September. China responded to the move on Tuesday. Customs Vice Minister Zhou Zhiwu.
Let me put it simply. It was the right choice and has positive implications for bilateral trade.
But the Treasury's decision hasn't sat well with everyone. According to some critics, China never should have got the label in the first place. One former senior Treasury official said the decision was made, quote, in a moment of presidential pique. But critics on the other side, like Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, blasted the Trump administration for backing down. In a statement, Schumer said, quote, unfortunately, President Trump would rather cave to President Xi Jinping than stay tough on China. The world's two largest economies are getting ready to sign a deal to ease an 18-month-long trade war. Chinese Vice Premier Liu He is in Washington ahead of the ceremony, set to take place on Wednesday.
That was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. As we just heard, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer sent a letter to President Trump ahead of the expected phase one signing deal tomorrow, reiterating that a weak deal that fails to adequately address the structural inequalities in the U.S.-China trade relationship will harm American workers for years to come. He also requested answers regarding concerning policies and practices reportedly left unaddressed as part of the initial deal with China. The International Maritime Bureau said in its annual piracy report that the number of sailors kidnapped off of West Africa surged by more than 50% last year. A maritime watchdog announced on Tuesday, urging greater international cooperation to reduce piracy. The IMB says the number of crew snatched there jumped from 78 in 2018 to 121 last year, amounting to over 90% of kidnappings reported at sea worldwide. India's Supreme Court on Tuesday dismissed pleas for review of the death sentence handed down to four men in the rape and murder of a young woman on a New Delhi bus, leaving an appeal to the president as their only possible recourse. The 2012 attack on the 23-year-old physiotherapy student on a moving bus shocked India and led to tough new laws against sexual violence, including the death penalty for rape in some cases. Cambodian opposition party leader Kem Sokha is to go on trial for treason Wednesday in a closely watched case as the European Union considers suspending trade benefits over the Southeast Asian nation's human rights record. Defense lawyers say it could take up to 3 months to deliver a verdict. Kem Sokha was arrested in 2017 and his opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party was banned ahead of a 2018 election in which the party of longtime leader Hun Sen won all the parliamentary seats. A volcano near the Philippine capital spewed lava into the sky and trembled constantly Tuesday, potentially signaling a bigger and more dangerous eruption as tens and thousands of other people fled villages darkened and blanketed by heavy ash. Government work was suspended and schools were closed in a number of towns and cities, including Manila, because of health risk from ash. Hundreds of flights were also canceled or delayed, affecting tens of thousands of passengers. The Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology says the continuous restiveness of the Taal volcano and several new fissures on the ground nearby likely means magma is rising and may lead to further eruptive activity. The volcano was spurting fountains of red-hot lava 800 meters into the sky, and the massive column of ash and volcanic debris at times lit up with streaks of lightning. Now, to learn more about the Taal volcano, VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke to volcanologist Tracy Gregg, who is an associate professor of geology at the University of Buffalo.
Taal is an unusual volcano, and one of the problems that the people are facing right now is kind of bad press about this volcano. It's continually referred to as a small volcano, and if you look at a satellite photo or a map, what you see is Tall Volcano, which is a mountain that's surrounded by a lake. It's called Lake Tall or Tall Lake, depending on whom you ask. And what people aren't quite grasping, I think, is that what they're calling Tall Volcano, this little island, is actually sitting inside a volcanic crater, and the volcanic crater is the lake. And so it's not a small volcano. It's one of the biggest volcanoes. The activity is concentrated on this little kind of satellite or parasitic volcano that's in the center of this big volcanic caldera.
So when they are talking about the possibility of tsunami, they're really talking about that, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. The Tall Lake is not far from the ocean coast, and if it were to generate a big explosive eruption, that could then create what we call pyroclastic flows. These are these flows of hot ash and gas that flow down the sides of a volcano, and they can go at speeds over 100 miles an hour. And if those hit the ocean in big amounts, then that pyroclastic flow displaces the ocean water. It pushes it away, and that can generate a tsunami.
What about people returning now after they are saying, well, they were sent away from their homes, and now it doesn't seem to be all that bad? That happens all the time, doesn't it, with volcanoes?
It does. And the problem with volcanoes is, the way I describe it is that every volcano has its own personality. So, for example, I have an older sister, and I know exactly how far I can push her or tease her. And then her eyebrow will twitch, and I know I need to back off because that's the sign she's going to blow. Every volcano has its own signs that it's going to blow. We don't know what Tall's signs are. It's the last time it had a big catastrophic eruption was 100,000 years ago. We didn't have volcanologists or people monitoring this volcano at that time. So we don't know what to look for to predict one of these big eruptions. So we don't know.
How far have we come as far as being able to predict something like that? Obviously not all the way, but how far?
Certainly not far enough. It absolutely depends on the volcano. So for volcanoes where we have covered them with instruments and can recognize what those signs mean. So good examples would be Kilauea volcano in Hawaii or Mount St. Helens in Washington State. Those volcanoes have been active in recent memory, right, since the 1980s. And they have instruments all over them. The instruments are continually monitored. So as soon as there's some kind of change in the volcano's behavior, we can run outside and look and see how that change in behavior corresponds to whether it's going to erupt or not. The vast majority of volcanoes on this planet are not monitored. There's just not the money and the time and the resources to monitor every single volcano. So there's that problem. And the other problem is that volcanoes live on a different time scale than humans do, right? We can kind of grasp things that happen within a 75-year time scale, like, you know, our grandparents' stories. We got that. But we consider a volcano to be active if it has erupted sometime in the last 10,000 years. Humans don't operate on a 10,000-year time scale.
That was University of Buffalo geology professor Tracy Gregg speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. And this quick update on Sudan. An official said Tuesday that security forces have contained an armed protest from within the security apparatus amid reports of unrest. Sudan's Minister of Information, Faisal Mohamed Salah, called on the, quote, rebellious forces to hand over their weapons. There have been no reports of casualties among security forces or civilians. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Aydin Uko, thank you very much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. And you can also find archived copies of the show on the program page under the live radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.